Good morning. My name is Todd Green, and I am the Community Affairs Officer and the Vice President for Community and Economic Development here at the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta. And it's my pleasure to welcome you here today to the Community Reinvestment Act hearing. These hearings are sponsored by the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System, the Office of Thrift Supervision, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. So try saying that five times really quickly. And fortunately, today's meeting is being chaired by the Office of Thrift Supervision, our regulator partner. So on behalf of Dennis Lockhart, our president, I welcome you here today. And as you know, we're here to consider changes to the Community Reinvestment Act. And I am pleased to introduce my colleague, John Bowman, who will be the presiding officer for today. If you have any questions, our staff people are located around the building, and we're pleased to assist you with whatever you need. And with that, I'll turn it over to John.
Todd, thank you very much. Good morning. My name is John Bowman. I'm the Acting Director of the Office of Thrift Supervision. Welcome to the second of four public hearings designed to explore possible ways to improve the Community Reinvestment Act regulations. I am pleased that the OTS had the opportunity to organize today's hearing along with the other federal agencies that evaluate CRA performance. And I would like to extend special thanks to the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta for graciously providing us with such an appealing venue for this event. My colleagues here this morning, some in person, some on the phone, include Martin J. Grunberg, Vice Chairman of the FDIC, who will be joining us or has joined us by phone, Tim Berniston, Senior Associate Director at the Federal Reserve Board, and Beth Castro, Director of Community Development at the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. Each of us will make a few opening remarks before we begin the most important business, hearing from our panelists. The CRA requires financial institutions to meet the credit needs of their entire communities, including low and moderate income areas. Consistent with this mandate, both the CRA and the agency's implementation of these rules encourage institutions to maintain branches in low and moderate income neighborhoods and to develop innovative products and services for lower income households. CRA also provides the impetus for financial institutions and community-based organizations to collaborate to promote access to credit and related banking services for underserved communities. The last comprehensive revisions to the CRA regulations were made in 1995. Since that time, the banking industry and the financial markets have significantly changed. The needs of low and moderate income households and underserved communities have changed too. We are holding these hearings to see if changes to the rules are also needed, and if so, what those changes should be. Notably, we are conducting CRA hearings in different parts of the country to gain insights on regional and local perspectives on those issues. Many questions can be discussed as we consider how to remodel the CRA rules. While the responses to some of these questions would require legislation to implement, the emphasis today and throughout the four hearings is on regulatory changes that would come within the purview of the agencies represented here. A key topic for today is how residents of underserved communities can receive better access to financial services. We want to hear your observations about what CRA got right in promoting the development of products and services that help consumers become part of the financial mainstream. We are also interested in your thoughts about changes necessary to provide unbanked and underbanked populations with better access to affordable, and I will emphasize responsible, financial products and services. In addition to physical bank branch networks, with what innovative alternative delivery methods can be used to meet these needs? I am interested in hearing your views. We also invited today's participants to address how smaller institutions have met the credit needs of distressed and underserved communities, including rural areas. It is critical that all of these communities benefit from a CRA structure that is responsive and innovative, whether the economy is functioning robustly or under stress. At the first CRA hearing, in Arlington, Virginia, some participants suggested that we revise the CRA regulations to encourage institutions to offer a variety of asset and wealth building products in underserved communities. I hope to hear more about such approaches today. In considering these and other questions, we, the four agencies represented here today, are committed to working with all stakeholders to ensure that the mission of CRA continues to be fulfilled. We are keenly interested in taking steps to ensure that the CRA rules continue to provide an incentive for institutions to provide financial products and services to communities and consumers in a responsible, affordable, and sustainable manner. Your input is invaluable in this process. I'd like to thank you all for participating in this hearing, and I look forward to your insights and thoughtful recommendations. I'd now like to ask Vice Chairman Gruenberg for his remarks.
John, thank you very much. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you fine, Marty.
Great, thank you. I very much regret not being able to be at the hearing in person. I had planned to, but unfortunately there were problems with the flights down to Atlanta, so I'm going to participate electronically. And I would like particularly to thank the staff at the Federal Reserve Bank in Atlanta for allowing me to participate in this manner. The purpose of these hearings, as was stated in the Federal Register notice announcing them, is to receive public comment on the Community Reinvestment Act regulations and to solicit views on whether and how the four federal agencies responsible for supervising the Community Reinvestment Act should revise the regulations to better serve the goals of CRA. As John indicated, this is the second of four hearings the agencies are holding. The first was in Arlington, Virginia, and on August 12th there will be a hearing in Chicago, and on August 17th there will be a hearing in Los Angeles. As John also indicated, there has not been a comprehensive review of the regulations implementing CRA since 1995. During the past 15 years, as is well understood, there have been dramatic changes in the financial services industry. We have moved from an industry in which most banks and had branches in one state to an industry in which many institutions have branches in multiple states and a number have deposit facilities nationwide. Some institutions now conduct the majority of their deposit and lending activities using alternative delivery systems such as the Internet. The basic purpose of CRA, to expand access to credit and basic banking services on a sustainable basis to homeowners, small businesses, and consumers in underserved communities, has never been more relevant, particularly given the current challenging credit market environment. Low and moderate income and minority communities have been particularly impacted by tight credit market conditions. In light of that, as well as the dramatic changes in banking over the past 15 years, it makes sense to consider whether and how CRA could be made more effective. These hearings are designed to solicit a diverse range of views on CRA. Although they are not limited to particular topics, the agencies outlined in the Federal Register notice a broad set of issues on which we are seeking public comment, including geographic coverage, CRA performance tests and asset thresholds, affiliate activities, small business and consumer lending evaluations and data, access to banking services, community development, ratings and incentives, and the effect of evidence of discriminatory or other illegal credit practices on CRA evaluations. I note today's hearing will particularly focus on access to banking services and the services test, which is a critical issue. In conclusion, if I may, I would like to commend Director Bowman and the staff of the Office of Thrift Supervision for organizing today's hearing and assembling the outstanding and extensive array of witnesses who are prepared to testify. And I would also like to thank the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta for serving as the allowing us to use their facility. Thank you all very much.
Thank you. Tim? Tim Burniston?
Thank you, John. Welcome, and thank you all for coming. I'm Tim Burniston. I'm a Senior Associate Director in Washington, D.C. for the Federal Reserve Board. And originally, Ana Alvarez Boyd and I were going to share the responsibilities today, but unfortunately also due to travel problems brought on by not only weather but mechanical issues resulting in a series of flight cancellations, Ana won't be able to be with us today. She regrets not being here and was truly looking forward to being with you. I also want to thank not only the OTS for coordinating today's hearing, but the tremendous efforts of Todd Green and his extremely capable staff, as well as other staff of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta for making today's arrangements. In particular, I'd like to mention Paige Denard, Chevelle Wilson, and Nancy Varell, who worked very hard putting this together. As was noted by John and Marty, this is the second of four hearings that the agencies are hosting on CRA regulatory modernization. The primary topics for today's hearing are access to financial services and meeting the needs of distressed and underserved communities, including rural communities. These topics are of particular interest to the agencies and particularly to the Federal Reserve, and in fact, their importance has been at the core of our community affairs programs for many years. In fact, in the Fed's case, back when our program was established in 1984. There's been a long tradition of working with organizations and the industry to support and facilitate community development and to promote access to financial services for low and moderate income people and others. Our Community Investment Center in San Francisco and our Bank On programs in many cities across the nation, including Jacksonville and Tampa, are clear examples of the commitment that we all have now and in the future. We look forward to listening to today's panelists. The diversity of views represented in this room today should help us gain a clearer picture of the issues and the interests we must consider as we embark on our task. I do want to note that there are two panelists among our first group of presenters, Mr. Stegman and Ms. Radcliffe, who contributed insightful papers to an effort spearheaded by the Federal Reserve Banks of Boston and San Francisco, as well as the board, to capture some of the best thinking available on possible CRA modernization issues. Their papers were included in a publication that I would recommend to all of you. Your local Federal Reserve Community Affairs staff can help you get a copy of that publication. I'd also like to mention Mike Griffin is a current member of the Fed's Consumer Advisory Council. Thanks for letting me say a few words, and I look forward to today's hearing. Thanks.
Beth Gastrom.
Thank you, Director Bowman, and thanks to all who organized the hearing and who will participate today in our hearing. The federal banking agencies are holding these hearings to hear your views on how we can better achieve the goals of the Community Reinvestment Act. The recently enacted financial reform legislation will also bring significant changes to the nation's banking system. That legislation, along with the vast changes in the composition of the industry and how financial services are offered, suggests that now is a uniquely pertinent time to examine the CRA regulations. Although some of the changes that have been discussed in the CRA debate will require legislation, there are others that can be addressed by regulatory adjustments, and that is the purpose of this hearing today. We look forward to the hearing and how we can update the CRA regulations. Today's hearing will focus on several topics. The first, access to financial services, presents some particularly interesting issues in light of all of the changes in how both the industry and how financial services are delivered today. I look forward to hearing your views on this topic. Of equal importance are other topics that we'll be exploring today, such as the effectiveness of the small bank institution performance criteria and how CRA can best meet the needs of distressed and underserved areas, including rural areas, as well as regional concerns about CRA. Previously, our comptroller has underscored how CRA is an important bridge that unites banking customers, the banks themselves, and their community stakeholders in successful community development partnerships. CRA supports banks doing what they do best and should support what they want to do well. That is, making viable lending, services, and investment decisions in their own communities that are consistent with their business plans and with acceptable rates of return. I welcome all of the businesses who, all of the witnesses, excuse me, who are here today, and look forward to hearing your views and to learning more from the public comments on the topics and questions that the hearings cover today.
Thank you, Beth. Marty, if we could have you mute your phone.
Oh, okay.
We'd appreciate that.
We'll do that.
All right. Thank you. Our today's first panel is Janice Bodler, the Deputy Director of Wealth Building, National Council of the RASA, Michael Stegman, who is the Director of Housing and Policy for the MacArthur Foundation, Yannicka Ratcliffe, Associate Director, Center for Community Capital, Michael Griffin, who is the Senior Vice President for KeyBank, and Melissa, and please excuse me if I mispronounce your last name, Kobe?
Coity.
All right, the Policy Director for the Center for Financial Services Innovation. And if I could, I would ask that each panelist will limit their remarks to 5 minutes. The timekeeper at the front, Nicola Kelly, will indicate when there is 1 minute remaining and when the time is up. Following your presentations, I will start the rotation of the questions among the principals. Each principal will also have 5 minutes, and if time permits, the principals will have a second round of questions. Since this event is being recorded, we would ask that you speak into the microphone. Thank you so much. Janice?
Well, thank you very much. I'm excited to be able to kick off the discussion this morning. My name is Janice Bowdler. I'm the Deputy Director of the Wealth Building Policy Project at National Council of La Raza. For those of you that may not be familiar with NCLR, we are the nation's largest Hispanic civil rights organization in the country. CRA leverages private investment towards a fundamental public policy goal, and that is the fair and equal distribution of banking services in all neighborhoods, regardless of the racial, ethnic, or income composition of its residents. The focus of today's hearing is on leveraging CRA to improve access to financial services, but at the heart of this conversation is how to reestablish CRA as a compelling and dynamic force in this marketplace. In my remarks today, I will open with a couple of points about CRA modernization, and then I will focus on CRA exams as a tool to increase access to financial services. It should probably go without saying, but just so we're all clear, the policy goals of CRA are still valid and high in demand from communities of color. Latino, immigrant, low-income, and unbanked households face serious barriers to banking services, and without deliberate intervention, these barriers will inhibit their progress, their financial progress. The question is, what is holding CRA back from achieving its purpose in totality? While there may be others, we have three core concerns, some of which have already been mentioned in the discussion. CRA does not cover all financial institutions that are in the business of banking. Many of the banks are conducting business well beyond the walls of their branches, and therefore we're limited in the scope of a CRA assessment. And one issue that we're particularly concerned about, that is grade inflation, which has made the CRA exam a less credible threat to underperforming institutions. Yet the forces that set CRA in motion, discrimination and disparate treatment of neighborhoods, have rebounded in force. Communities once served predominantly by banks have been inundated by retail dealers outside the scope of CRA. Mortgage brokers and finance companies, subprime credit card providers, payday lenders, and auto dealers. The need for CRA is just as real today as it was three decades ago. And in that context, let me turn to ways in which the CRA exams could better leverage services to the unbanked. This is a particular issue to my community, Latino families, nearly half of which are un- or underbanked. Families relied on a wide range of basic financial products, things like checking and savings accounts, debit cards, remittances, check cashing, and starter credit, just to conduct their daily household business. Good products will help put families on a path to greater financial opportunity, and in the short term and in a time where the recession is really pressing all families, but particularly in low-income communities and communities of color, good products are going to help them save money. However, most banks do not see these products or LMI consumers as highly profitable endeavors. Therefore, they don't invest in them heavily. In addition, CRA exams do not make basic banking a priority. To address these issues in the regulatory context, we recommend changes to the service and community development tests. I'll start with the service test, which is the primary mechanism for evaluating basic banking services. As we've, I think, has already been alluded to in this hearing and in others, because there's such a focus on physical branches, we're really missing ways in which banks and other companies are attracting their customers. So we need to start to look beyond that. So in addition to that, we need to collect robust data. Much of this data is already being collected by the banks. It's just not being collected in the context of CRA assessment. Use that to create meaningful standards, and then give credit for banking services accessible by low-income, underserved, or non-bank customers. And this should be quantified and assessed the same way that we do with loans. An alternative strategy is to look at the community development test. There are many financial institutions that, for a variety of reasons, are not going to be able to meet all of the needs that the community has. So instead, they can facilitate the delivery of services through institutions that have access and expertise. So four principles for that, just quickly. An investment in another institution must be sizable enough to allow the recipient institution to overcome and compensate for any gaps left by the investor. The investment in the banking services should be community-driven. The exam criteria that would normally apply to the investor should also extend to whichever institution they're investing in, whether it be a community bank, credit union, or private company. And lastly, investments should be graded on performance rather than mere presence of an investment. We have additional thoughts on how these strategies can work together in harmony, but I'll save that for the Q&A. Thank you.
Thank you. Michael Stegman.
Good morning. My name is Michael Stegman. I'm Director of Housing and Policy at the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. I speak today on ways to strengthen the CRA service test in my personal capacity and not on behalf of the foundation. I'm pleased to be testifying about the service test because I believe, as does the vice chairman of the FDIC and many others, that access to a basic bank account and financial services is a starting point for economic opportunity. And on this score, banks are not doing very well. While from 1989 to 2009, the share of unbanked black and Hispanic families has fallen from about a third to a still high 21%, this compares to just 3% of all non-Hispanic white households. So despite some progress, on a relative basis, there is still seven times more unbanked black and Hispanics than there are of whites, a minority achievement gap, I would argue, that should be as unacceptable in financial regulation policy as it is in education policy. These facts alone make a strong case for creating more effective and a more performance-based service test. Add to this the likelihood that financial reform will usher in an era of low leverage and more conservative underwriting standards that will require additional upfront cash to buy a home, even for low and moderate income families. And we know that accumulating savings is all the harder when one lacks a bank account. While not arguing for a stronger service test per se, FDIC's 2008 study of banks' efforts to meet the needs of underserved populations supports such a case. While noting that most surveyed banks offered basic checking accounts, the survey still found major gaps in their product offerings. Said FDIC, and I quote, "Few offered deposit, payment, credit, and electronically based products that address the unique needs of unbanked and underbanked customers." According to the report, as is true with much related research on the topic, lack of profitability continues to be banks' greatest defense of this collective lackluster record. The debate about profitability and long-term revenue potential of first account products has been with us as long as the argument that unbanked and underbanked persons are better served and more satisfied with their dealings with non-banks, such as payday lenders and check cashers, than they are with banks. I remain unconvinced by both arguments, which leads to my two most important recommendations for how to strengthen the CRA. While these would require new legislation, I should remind you that my written testimony that I submitted earlier in the week contains several recommendations for strengthening the service test that could be implemented under existing law. Returning to the lack of profit argument, I really don't believe that policymakers have sufficient reliable data on the economics of account products and services to effectively regulate this area of activities. While there is more solid evidence confirming underserved populations' greater satisfaction dealing with non-banks, caution is warranted interpreting these data as well. This is because these surveys compare preferences and transparent prices of non-bank products against an inadequate menu of poorly designed mainstream banking products that are embedded in a far more opaque and, in many cases, anti-consumer pricing system. I propose two actions to address these problems. The first is an independent audit of the cost and revenue structure of transaction accounts and savings products offered by large banks. The goal is to identify the costs and revenue structures of basic account products and services, operating margins, the presence of scale economies, the sensitivity of indirect cost allocations on product profitability analysis, and so forth. The second proposal is to create an independent institute for financial innovation research and evaluation. This nonprofit entity would be modeled after the internationally recognized MIT Poverty Action Lab, which uses rigorously designed randomized evaluations to answer questions critical to poverty alleviation across the globe. These same techniques would be used to answer questions about the efficacy, effectiveness, and economic sustainability of innovative financial services, technologies, platforms, delivery channels, and marketing strategies in meeting the needs and preferences of unbanked and underbanked individuals. Who should pay for this? CRA-covered mega institutions should pay for it. As a partial way to discharge a new CRA overlay responsibility that I would impose upon them called a duty to lead. Today, America's 10 largest CRA-covered institutions have aggregate deposits of more than $3 trillion and a combined market share of 45%. Not only should this top tier of America's banks have an obligation to meet the credit needs of their communities, as the CRA currently requires, but they should have an additional duty to lead the financial services industry in the development, testing, and commercialization of innovative, affordable, and sustainable account and credit products serving low-income families and underserved communities. Such an overlay over existing regulatory requirements has a precedent in the federal regulation of the GSEs. Thank you.
Ms. Radcliffe.
Thank you, Director Bowman, and other regulatory agencies for inviting me to share thoughts on the Community Reinvestment Act, particularly the service test. I am Yannicka Radcliffe, Associate Director at the UNC Center for Community Capital. Your review comes at a critical time as our financial system is being rethought and communities and families trying to rebuild. Today, as in 1977, the hope is that CRA can foster a more inclusive path to financial opportunity that strengthens all of our communities. The role of the Act in mortgage lending has received much attention. Ample evidence shows that while the broader market pursued reckless practices, CRA loans remained a constructive source of credit for low-income and minority families. Mortgage lending is not the only test, but it and small business lending are dominant evaluation factors because access to such productive capital is critically important for communities to flourish. But building financial opportunity from the ground up doesn't begin with home ownership. CRA encourages banks to meet the need for credit services as well as deposit services, thereby recognizing that basic financial services are the gateway to other opportunities. If that is true, then we have a problem. As you know, a recent FDIC survey finds a quarter of U.S. households un- or underbanked, including 54% of black and 43% of Hispanic households. Nearly one in five lower-income households does not have a bank account at all. Further, between 35 and 70 million Americans lack sufficient credit history to determine a credit score. For such individuals, reliance on alternative financial services adds costs and handicaps one's chance of achieving greater financial security. Yet, from the ratings on CRA tests, it would appear that our banks are meeting the credit needs of the communities just fine. In the prior 2 years, 98% of large banks rated satisfactory or better, and rejections of bank applications on CRA grounds are extremely rare. Consider Charlotte in this region, where Wachovia and Bank of America hold 92% of deposits and both received outstanding ratings on their 2006 service test. Yet in this banking city, 37% of households are un- or underbanked, above the national average. We can only conclude that the service test must be measuring the wrong thing. It is time to find a new approach, and we offer two recommendations. First, better assessment tools. In 1989, the passage of FIREA advanced the public availability of both CRA ratings and HMDA data. Today, HMDA provides information on access to and quality of mortgage credit that's widely used by community advocates, researchers, policymakers, and the industry itself. And it allows for a data-driven mortgage lending test. In contrast, the CRA service test is very subjective. This subjectivity creates an opportunity for grade inflation, as described in research by Michael Stegman. The most tangible element in the test is a review of the distribution of branches and ATMs across socioeconomic neighborhood status for randomly selected markets. Branch presence is important for serving communities, but in and of itself does not mean the needs are being met. Imagine on the mortgage side if all we knew was whether a lender had offices located in LMI census tract, but only for some markets for that lender, only for some years. And imagine we had to get that information in narrative form by going through each lender's examination. What could we possibly discern about the provision of mortgage loans to lower-income and minority households? A more quantitative service test could, to quote HMDA or paraphrase it, determine whether depository institutions are filling their obligations to serve the financial services needs of the communities and neighborhoods in which they are located. Our second recommendation is to better address the needs of the community using a consumer-centered view. Underserved consumers needed low-cost bank accounts. They did not need checking accounts that are advertised as free, but with built-in snares that had those with the least disposable income cross-subsidizing checking accounts for the rest of us. They need low-cost savings accounts, not accounts where the monthly fees far outweigh the interest that can be earned. In an FDIC survey of banks, less than 18% identify expanding services to the un- and underbanked as a priority, and most have undertaken no research on this potential opportunity. But there is extensive research available into what underbanked and low-income people want in transaction accounts. We can also look to the nonprofit community-based financial institutions as a further source of insights. Research also tells us that the needs go beyond accounts, mortgages, and business loans. One of the clearest needs is for small consumer loans, provided they're responsible, transparently priced, and repayable. Today, consumer lending is a minor element in the evaluation and should be given more weight. In closing, I encourage you to broaden the service test through incorporating the community perspective in defining credit needs and to collect more quantitative data to determine how well those needs are being met. Thank you for your attention, and I'll be pleased to answer questions.
Thank you. Mr. Griffin.
Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today about access to financial services. As has been stated, my name is Michael Griffin. I serve as a Senior Vice President for Community Development for KeyBank. And I must say, as the only practicing banker on the panel, I feel like a poinsettia in Lent, a little out of place in season. But I'll do my best. In my current role, I'm responsible for the bank's CRA compliance program and asset management of our community development investments. In this position, I've been very involved in the development and implementation of Key's significant outreach to the unbanked and the underbanked. We've been privileged to work with some of the organizations and individuals on this panel as we pioneered this effort. Over the past 6 years, Key's KeyBank Plus program has rolled out in 230 branches across 9 of our districts throughout the Midwest, Northeast, Rocky Mountains, and the Northwest. You'll notice all of those are cold weather areas. We don't get to anywhere where it's sunny. Through this program, we provide many basic banking services, including check cashing for non-depository clients and financial literacy, targeted to encourage clients to explore all their options as they choose how to manage their finances. Since its inception, we've enrolled 38,000 clients as check cashing clients and cashed over $130 million worth of checks with minimal losses. We initially pursued this course in response to the needs identified by 25% of our branches across our footprint that are located in low to moderate income areas. We recognize that these branches are not primarily in competition with other bank branches, but rather they're competing with non-traditional financial service providers. In 2004, we initiated our check cashing for non-depository clients at a rate lower than the surrounding check cashing companies. We did not do this with the intent of becoming a major long-term check casher, but more with an eye to removing one of the hurdles we had identified for clients to develop a relationship with a bank. Two of the hurdles we had identified were clients' distrust of banks in general and their confusion and distrust of the pricing of the primary product offered to entry-level clients, the checking account. If we could offer a product that clients knew and how it was and price it similar to how other providers did, we hoped they would at least cross the threshold of a bank and over time recognize that the staff reflected who they were and were people from their neighborhood who wanted to serve them. Over time, through financial literacy opportunities, we hoped they would learn of other opportunities available to them to manage their finances. And I want to emphasize that for us it's always about choice. Banks can develop and have developed free, and we can discuss what free means, products. But the reality is that maybe it not be the product that people want to use. So I think we all need to recognize that as we approach this market. Since its inception, KeyBank Plus program has grown to offer a variety of affordable services targeted to this population, including a card-based checking account that does not allow overdrafts, a small overdraft line of credit for clients who don't qualify for the mass market line, free money orders, and in addition, we've developed a significant focus ensuring that families claim their EITC benefits in a low-cost manner, primarily avoiding pay providers and RALs. We offer additional services with many more in development, including a small short-term loan product to responsible, I'll put in there, and responsibly priced product that we currently have in development. I offer all of this information not just to highlight the good work that we've done, but to draw attention to how all this work gets credited in the CRA exam. As we all know, the service test is 25% of the grade. In addition, there's a generally accepted guideline that 80% of the service test is based on branch placement. This means that all the additional items beyond branch placement that could be provided credit make up less than 5% of the overall exam. 5% for board services, financial literacy efforts, loan modification programs, development of products serving underbanked and unbanked, and all other community development services combined. Given the cost and staff focus it takes to develop new products, particularly in this current regulatory environment, it's hard to justify this effort by its weight in the CRA exam. In order to ensure that these community development services receive credit, they deserve a new method that must be devised to give them more weight. Whether this is part of the current of a new community development test or separate from the current three tests, or it's an explicit recognition of the existing service test that these activities should be given more weight, something needs to change. While Key sees these activities as important to attracting this segment of the market, serving our community, given their not always stellar profitability from these combined activities, it makes them difficult to justify solely from a cross-benefit point of view. To truly incentivize these activities, some reworking of the service test will be needed. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning to discuss the Community Reinvestment Act with you. My name is Melissa Coide, and I'm the Policy Director for the Center for Financial Services Innovation. CFSI, as we're known, is a national nonprofit organization providing leadership, research, and insights on the financial services needs of underbanked consumers. Over a decade ago, many policymakers and thought leaders believed that access to bank accounts was the missing ingredient that, if present, would lead to increased financial stability for low and moderate income consumers. While that assumption was not completely wrong, we've since learned through extensive research over the past decade, many of my colleagues here have cited some of it, that there is that the financial lives of the low and moderate income consumers are just as complex as the middle and upper income households. We've learned some really important facts. First, 21 million consumers who already have a bank account are nevertheless using non-bank financial services in a variety of ways. Second, we know that these consumers often elect to use these non-bank financial services even when a bank is in close proximity to that provider. And even though these choices may seem uneconomical when compared to the alternatives, they may not necessarily be if you consider the overdraft charges oftentimes that we've seen with the bank products. Moreover, many of these services offer a transparency, reliability, a convenience, as well as liquidity and ease of use that can far outweigh what may seem like disproportional costs. But we also know that no matter what their attractive features, these products often come with high costs, either directly through fees on the products themselves or indirectly through the structures of the products. And finally, we know that banks themselves have not typically developed affordably priced financial services for this consumer segment. There are, however, promising transaction, savings, and small dollar credit products that banks are offering directly and indirectly that benefit consumers and that offer sustainability for the providers. For example, millions of consumers across the country are using prepaid debit cards. While the bank isn't necessarily directly interfacing with the consumer, the bank is playing a very essential role in providing the cards, issuing the products, holding the cardholders' monies, as well as extending some very important consumer protections to the consumers through that role. Access to safe and affordable small dollar credit is a pressing financial services need that really warrants and develops focused CRA attention. There are some great examples of banks that are providing direct-to-consumer credit, as we saw through the FDIC small dollar loan pilot. However, to significantly expand the availability of good loans at a scale that can truly affect market price and competition, it may be as important for banks to play indirect roles in providing these services. As examples, banks can provide capital to responsible small dollar lenders, thus enabling those lenders to expand and grow their business and expand the availability of good products. Banks can also develop and distribute responsibly designed loans through intermediaries, including employers and national and local nonprofits. More now than ever, there is a policy imperative to change the CRA to reward banks for meeting the financial services needs of consumers with products that are safe, affordable, sustainable, and credit-building where appropriate. We have three recommendations to that goal. First, we believe the CRA should reward banks directly and indirectly for meeting the financial services needs of this consumer base. This can be achieved by strengthening and adding weight to the service test and by offering banks a new enhanced or dedicated strategic plan option that for those institutions that would like to focus a significant share of their activity on these particular services. Under this type of dedicated strategic plan option, banks would set out multi-year goals, what their resources are, what their strategies are, and what their capacities are for meeting the financial needs of the consumers they're serving. And with that multi-year time frame, it would encourage banks to test new products, new delivery channels, technologies, financial capability tools, and delivery channels in order to really meet these consumers' needs. Banks that opt for this plan would still be required to present their lending and investment activities in their assessment areas. And like the strategic plan option that currently exists today, the plan would include measurable annual goals by which these banks would be assessed, as well as a public comment period. Our second recommendation is that banks are given credit for financial services that are quality products, that are safe and affordable. Encouraging banks to serve these consumers without taking into account quality of services can lead to bad results for the consumers, for the industry, as well as for the economy at large. Accomplishing this goal is in part a matter of examiner training and judgment against a set of standards that will take time to develop. Bank regulators have access to data about these products that banks are offering. That information could be used in order to assess whether or not credit is warranted. We also suggest that the CRA regulators work very closely with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. This bureau will have a substantial role in understanding the product offerings in the marketplace. Ideally, those responsible for CRA and the CFPB would coordinate and share data and learnings and identify strategies and policies to increase low and moderate income consumers' access to safe and affordable financial products and services. Our third recommendation is to ensure that CRA is responsive to the changes in the financial services marketplace. It is essential that banking regulators continue to reflect and calibrate the regulations and the examination practices to maximize CRA's strength and responsiveness to new developments in technology, new product innovations, and new information about consumers. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll now move into the second phase I will start off a round of questions for the panel. The panelists are to limit ourselves as well to 5 minutes each. At the conclusion of the first round, if we have time remaining, we will go into a second round of questions. My first question, and this is to all of the panelists, Given the availability of alternative delivery mechanisms, should less emphasis be placed on branch location and more emphasis on institutions' delivery of affordable products? And to get away from an easy sort of a high inside fastball here, let me sort of add the second part of it, which is how would we as the regulators go about measuring and incorporate those changes into our ratings? Ms. Bodler. We only have 5 minutes.
Okay. I knew there was going to be a problem with sitting in the first chair, Harry. a couple of thoughts, because the time is short, and I do talk about some of this in my written statement. Our view is that that there should be evaluation wherever business is conducted. And so to the extent that companies or banks are soliciting deposits online or via agents outside of their branch area, that we should be incorporating and looking at that. I want to note that branches play a very important role for Latino families, for immigrant families, when they're done really well, as it sounds like some of the examples that we heard from Mike. They can really be touchstones for the community. They get a lot of questions answered. But just the presence of a branch is not an indicator of quality service. And so both the emphasis that we put on branches, evaluating the branch needs to change, and we need to look beyond the branch to anywhere that that bank or thrift is doing business.
Mr. Stegman.
I think the short answer is yes. We should put less evidence on it. Michael made an interesting point. The 80%, I don't know if that's teaching to the test. I don't know if that's because that's the area of financial services that we can count, and if what we measure, we invest in. And so I think we need to focus on outcomes, and we have to know more about the extent of low-income and underserved accounts in the geographies in which the banks operate. Now, we can't do it on a loan by an account by account basis because we don't have the income, but we do know what percentage of an assessment area is low and moderate income. We ought to know what kind of account flow is coming from those places, and whether it's through hard branches or cell phone based technologies or alternative smart ATMs, whatever. The question is, how well is the institution doing in meeting the service needs of its population? And so I do think that we have to measure more.
Thank you. I guess it would be really helpful to have some evidence as to the extent to which these alternative delivery systems are actually bringing in more LMI account holders, or whether actually they're serving more higher income clients. And you know, the prepaid debit card is one example where we probably see more of the former, but I think some of these other channels are not necessarily being utilized to their full capacity, much like a branch might not be, to serve that community. So I think before, yes, I agree with everything that has been said before me, that measurements are key, but I would like to start by understanding how these alternative delivery mechanisms are serving these CRA service objectives today, and then build tests around that.
I guess I would say I'm somewhat reluctant to say to have a de-emphasis of branch placement. Just because, as having worked for community development corporations prior to coming to the bank, having a branch in the neighborhood matters. Having some banking services there matters. So I guess what I'd like to see is not sort of a zero-sum game, but sort of somewhere else, a boost in the additional services that are being provided. So either expand the service test, the percentage of that, or have some overlying community development test. And as far as how to measure it, I guess my general view is you take the products that everyone would agree serves the unbanked, the underbanked, and look at the take-up on that product by MSA as we currently look at everything else for the CRA exam.
I think I generally agree with everything my colleagues here have said. I, I think it's a tough question because I think you do have to pause and reflect on the type of institution and the way in which that institution is offering transaction savings, small dollar credit products. It's not a cookie-cutter approach to this by any means, and so you've got to be able to build in some of that flexibility to respond when it is a local bank that clearly is doing this through their branches. You want to really value that through the CRA. I would also say, though, that when it comes to thinking about capturing more information and measuring, one of the really important questions that we don't have answers to is what are the longer-term implications of using some of these products, and how long do consumers use these products? So,
good. Thank you. My time is up, but I will be following up if we have a second round. We both talked about branches. We've talked about the limited impact of some of those branches, and I'd like your ideas in terms of, if you don't do away with branches, how do you get better penetration, if you will, into some of these communities, and alternative delivery mechanisms may be one way. But with that, I'll turn it over to Vice Chairman Grunberg.
Thank you, John. And thank you to all of the witnesses for their thoughtful testimony. And let me follow up on the question that John raised, because I think this issue of branch location and the weight given to branch location versus other services may well be the central issue here. And I do think Mr. Griffin in his testimony framed the issue nicely when he indicated that 80% of the services test currently is based on branch placement. Compared to the demographics of the MSA, I gather there's agreement among the witnesses that currently there's disproportionate weight placed on branch location. It's not that branch location is not important, but the current services test perhaps places too much weight on it and does not give sufficient attention to the actual services being provided in the branch location and the appropriateness of those services. If I can just ask quickly, is that a view generally shared by our witnesses?
Yes.
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 And if that's the case, I would be interested in their thoughts. If we're going to look at other at the services that are actually offered in the branch beyond the actual location in the neighborhood, do you have a set of priorities in terms of the services that should be made available in communities? I'd be interested in your thoughts if you're going to look at the services test and perhaps give greater weight to the services provided beyond the location of the branch, looking at the range of services that could be offered, if you had to identify the one, two, or three key services that you would like to see greater weight given to, I'd be interested in your thoughts if you could identify any priorities. If we could just ask each of the panelists their thoughts on that.
Mr. Stegman, why don't you start it off?
In my brief remarks, I made some comments about alternative satisfactions with kind of non-bank services, and I hesitate to start there, but let me just say there are a range of related services that non-banks provide customers in these areas that bring the customers to the places, whether they're places to pay rent, bill paying, in New York, paying traffic tickets. I don't want to recommend lottery sales, but that does bring a lot of traffic to these places. In addition to check cashing and so on. But ultimately, if these are ancillary services, the good products have to be there. So we have to have responsive affordable mainstream services as well. But there are these other services that really bring a lot of folks to these non-bank providers.
So I think this ties nicely to the first question, because I think it highlights some of what maybe is a false dichotomy between do we look at branch location versus other services. And I think part of that problem comes from the fact that we have been in the service test measuring inputs as opposed to outcomes. So in my comments, I talked about the importance of measuring outcomes. And so, for example, you might measure the identified safe bank account provision across census tract of address of the account holder, something like that, and start measuring outputs instead of inputs, or outcomes instead of inputs. And that way, I think we can move a little bit away from how much weight should we give the branch distribution. If you're focusing on are people actually getting accounts and getting the services they need, then the branch, where's the branch location, becomes a little bit more of a secondary step in getting there. And then in terms of the other services of importance, clearly good savings accounts that really do enable asset building. And I think small dollar credit, as I've mentioned in my comments.
Good. Thank you.
I'm a little reluctant to specify products just based on different banks. They have different approaches, certainly. But certainly the savings, I mean, I think as a lot of us have learned over the last many years, providing credit is not always necessarily the best first option for folks who are having financial challenges. So certainly some sort of a savings and asset building component, and a lot of that can be supported through regulation and certainly legislation. And, you know, after that, I mean, all the things I think we've talked about, certainly check cashing is an important product. It's a gateway product for people. Remittances that are certainly important for a certain segment. Bill payment, as Michael said, certainly is something that attracts folks in. But the reality is a lot of those are already offered by a lot of banks. A lot of banks have remittance, have, you know, MoneyGram or whatever in their branch. They almost all have some sort of a low-cost savings product. I think the question for banks and for regulators also is how do we encourage, I mean, we're taking the approach if banks offer it, folks will come in. I guess the other point is how do we encourage customers to come into banks? There is definitely a barrier oftentimes with a bank. Either people have had bad experiences themselves or don't see banks as someone who want them as clients. So we both have to offer the product, but we also have to figure out how do we get people to come into a bank and see them as their first choice provider for financial services.
So I, at the end of the table, do agree with, oh, yes, Janice. I go back to my remarks. I mean, I think in some cases where banks are well-positioned to be offering direct transaction and savings account products to consumers, that's really valuable and they should be doing it. We've done some research on small-dollar credit needs and have just found really high need for access to these products. So I think that should be high on the list of the regulators as you think about the services test and how those needs can be met. But then I also think you do have to, in considering the variety of ways in which these products get delivered, that it's not always necessarily the bank that's going to be the front-facing entity providing these services. Again, there may be the bank that's behind some of these responsible providers who can be making those services available. And then also I would say where we see some really exciting innovations happening are these electronic account options like the prepaid cards, where you're actually adding on savings features to these products. So those kinds of products really should be paid attention to as well.
Thank you.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
I'm still here, Marty. I'm going to offer a couple comments as well. This is Janice. I got rotated out of the hot seat, and so now I'm batting cleanup. Just a couple of quick thoughts. I agree with the things that were said so far. But I think it needs to be a very community-driven process. I think it's likely that you could see demand for product and what the community actually needs vary considerably market to market. So I also hesitate to put out a top three of specific products. I want to emphasize two things. One is a comment that Janneke made earlier about technology and who it's attracting. And thinking about the technology that's going to attract the LMI consumer, I often have told banks that while they're doing really great on mobile banking and internet banking, I don't know that gets you to your LMI consumer. Rather, cell phones is probably a better investment, and thinking about how that is going to bring people into the bank. And then the last thing is thinking about how we can prioritize or quantify collaboration. Remittances is a good example. You could see a case where there's a huge community need for a remittance product, but perhaps the actual volume in that market is too low. Not every bank is going to offer a remittance product. But how can institutions be investing in one another to leverage to make sure that service is there, and thinking creatively about that? And there are a dozen other examples of this kind of scale versus access. But I think we need to think about that as well, and making sure that the needs are covered across the entire market, not just that every bank is offering a product to meet every single need, because I don't think that's going to be realistic.
Good. Thank you very much.
All right. Jim Berniston.
Thanks. I have a couple of questions. They're not quite as in-depth as John or Vice Chairman Grunberg's, but a little simpler. But could you guys just share any thoughts you have on what you actually think the weighting of services should have in determining a CRA rating? All of you have touched upon, or some of you have touched upon, the issue about how much weight within a test branches have and that sort of stuff. And I think there were some comments made about weighting services more in a CRA evaluation. I guess part of what we would have to think about is what does more mean, and also think about the effect that has on other things that would also need to be or should be considered as part of a CRA rating.
I'll go, keeping the pattern
like
going.
To go.
I'll jump in with the fact that until there's a better test, I don't necessarily know that I would give it a whole lot more weight. Mike's research has demonstrated, and it still holds true today, that the subjectivity of the current service test allows it to be, vulnerable to uses great inflation. And so I think, back to my points that I keep pounding, the robustness of the test should be improved, and then there might be discussion of what weight it should have for different tiers, categories. I do think for some of the maybe rural and smaller banks or intermediate-sized banks, the service aspect has somewhat gotten buried, I think, in the combined test, and so there might be a way to make that more tangible as well.
I guess I would say I haven't thought about the specific percentages. I guess I've more thought about if you left the service test sort of as it is and had an overall overlaying community development test that took sort of community development lending, community development investment, and the community development, these other services together, sort of overlay that over sort of the nuts and bolts of the existing CRA. I'm also going to take the chance. I just keep hearing great inflation, and every time I hear it, I sort of cringe. And I know that's a widely held belief that there is great inflation. I don't know about specific other institutions. But I guess the thing I keep coming back to is we're talking about how to encourage banks to do more of X, or more of Y. When there is no difference between a satisfactory and an outstanding, doing that extra, there isn't much encouragement there, except for the attaboy or sort of the self-good feelings a bank has about itself. There's nothing additional to benefit to get the outstanding rating. So something, it doesn't have to be huge, but there's got to be some additional recognition that a bank has gone above and beyond just getting by and has done that additional effort. So I don't know what it is. Lots of possibilities out there, but something's got to be done to give banks the credit for that outstanding rating.
So I would say that given that we know there's been research done to show what the savings is to the consumer if they're accessing a low-cost transaction product, given that we know savings is an essential step for short-term emergency needs, as well as starting to build longer-term wealth building and savings opportunities, and given that we know how important credit histories and good credit scores are, I think that the services test really does deserve more attention, which is what you've seen reflected in my remarks. I do come back to this need around flexibility. For those institutions that this is their primary strategic line of business or one that they really want to be pursuing further, they really should have the flexibility then in order to design a plan, a five-year trajectory on what they're going to be doing in order to meet those consumers' needs. I don't have an exact number to give you on how much more the service test ought to count under the CRA as it's currently designed. I think, though, that recognizing that we've got to give more weight to it and giving more of the banks who are thinking about really going after this consumer segment the latitude to do it and to do it smart and thoughtfully, reflecting where consumers are, is a real value.
So I'll go ahead and take a stab at throwing out numbers. So I have heard it recommended to shift the test one-third, one-third, one-third. And that is, I would say that for NCLR, the jury's still out on that because I'm not totally sure what that will do to mortgage lending. But I think we're open to thinking about that sort of one-third, one-third option. And what I think would make the difference and would make sure that we don't do anything to detract away from the mortgage side, which obviously is critical and we think is critical, is making sure that the test is rigorous enough that every point counts. And then we also recommend an overlay of a strategic plan, but I take away the optional of really mandating a strategic plan, again, giving the flexibility that they're going to, that a bank is going to devise its own business plan around these sorts of things, and they're going to make choices of whether they want to be primarily in one game or the other, or if they want to be in all of them. But if every point counts on the test, then shaking up that distribution shouldn't cause one to suffer over the other.
I have written that I would consider giving institutions some flexibility between the services test and the community and the investment test. There was some evidence that banks were having a hard time really meeting the requirements of the investment test as it was kind of narrowly defined, and that I would allow them, those institutions, to reduce the credit for the investment test and increase it, that is, kind of toggle between the investment test and the services test, that is, put more emphasis on services if in their kind of marketplace. Now with a national kind of global coverage, I'm not sure that the difficulty in meeting the investment test is that great. I would also point out if we made specifically the small consumer loan kind of issue part of the service test and really measured that, it would certainly warrant, it seems to me, considering increasing the weight of that test. If the small consumer loan product gets inserted into a broadened community development test, I would then leave the service test alone. I would reallocate some of the services that currently are counted on the service test that have more to do with mortgage lending, mortgage counseling, and all of those kinds of things, which I think really belong in either a community development test or a lending test, and make the community development services that are part of the services test really focus on financial services, small community, small dollar credit, and so on.
I have a couple of questions. One is about the strategic plan option. Currently, very few banks opt for the strategic plan type of option. So under the new suggestion of a consumer financial services strategic plan. I think, Ms. Carter, you had mentioned that. I guess my question would be, how might that have different results? In other words, it's optional now. I think you recommended that it be optional. And so how might you envision it becoming more advantageous for banks to take advantage of that and to do that?
So we thought about this option when considering more broadly the variety of ways that banks are playing in providing services and looking at the non-bank sector and the bank sector. And wanting to effectively use the CRA to provide a strong lever to make sure that the products that are being provided either directly through banks or through some of the non-bank providers are good quality products. So I think about institutions like MetaBank, for instance, which is a big issuer of prepaid cards. And they clearly are giving a lot of focus on the provision of those products. If a strategic plan option were available where they could get significant credit for providing those products and services, and it was clear that it was going to be valued and considered over a five-year span by the regulators, I think that kind of opportunity to really dedicate the resources and the capacities around providing the services under a strategic plan service test would be perhaps taken up more aggressively than we've seen it so far.
Okay, thank you. Several of you have indicated that consumer products and services should be included automatically in the CRA evaluation. Do you envision that for all size institutions, from small ISB and large, so everybody would have that component added into the CRA evaluation? Is that what you're thinking?
Yes. Did you want more explanation or just a yes or no?
No, I would like your explanation. Yeah, I'd like to understand because that would be an expansion, correct?
Sure. So I'll just briefly, yes, we think it should apply to institutions of every size, but I say that in context to, again, a strong need for this to be community-driven and for some flexibility and thinking about the totality of the market. So small institutions may be serving a niche need, and that's fine. It doesn't mean they have to offer every single kind of basic banking services that we've listed out, because it could mean a lot of different kinds of products. It's not that they have to offer a menu of every single one of these products, but the advantage of doing some sort of plan is to document that this is a community need. I've met that need, and I'm doing so robustly, especially for a small institution, again, that's filling a niche within a market that otherwise wouldn't be met, I think is critical.
Just in terms of the strategic plan option, that exists today and hasn't been used very much by institutions. I would like to really see and a kind of an evaluation of those that have used that and see what difference it really has made under current regulations before I would go to a broad option of a strategic plan. But and I also wouldn't use the strategic plan option just for financial services if we were moving in that direction away from the I would not have two quantitative tests and then a strategic plan for financial services. With respect to the small dollar issue, it's very frustrating to see products out there that have proven themselves, in some cases actually in the billions of dollars of originations, like the State Employees Credit Union salary advance loan, where they've done billions of dollars and several hundred thousand of these at a 12.75% APR, and not see successful electronic, technology-driven small consumer loan products pick up. The take-up by other institutions simply is not there. So I would like to make sure that kind of service where we have proven that the economics do work, certainly for large banks, to have that explicitly included in the service test.
Well, on the consumer products, I guess I want to make sure we don't, just because the bankers in the room will probably kill me, that doesn't include consumer lending, all consumer lending. If we have to report and geocode and do all the great stuff on consumer lending, you know, I know nobody wants to feel sympathy for a bank, but but it really would be just overwhelming, and at some point, I don't know the benefit that would come from that. So just want to make that clarification.
Okay. Thank you.
Certainly.
Can you hear me? Oh, there we go. Just one other note on the strategic plan, because I think we've talked about it in a couple of ways, and I don't disagree with anything that my colleagues have said, but one of the important, in my recommendations in my written statement, I recommended that to tie all of these pieces together, that there be some statement about the bank's strategy. So I didn't necessarily mean to imply that the strategic plan option as it exists now become mandatory. But I do think that having a plan is a way for the community to have input, which is sorely lacking now, especially as we see fewer and fewer mergers. The opportunity for formal input into the direction of bank services and for feedback from the community about what they need is lacking. So having a plan will help regulators sort of evaluate that, yes, these two or three investments that the bank is making is in response to things that the community has stated that they need. So they kind of there's a yin and yang there that I think is important, and I don't know how you would have one without the other. Products without being tied to a community need just aren't functional.
Or sustainable.
Well, if I can just add to that, I mean, one thing I guess is,
That's all right, please.
Am I running the buck here? One thing about, you know, the community input and comment, I guess I'm always amazed when we go to have a CRA exam that we don't get more comment in advance. I mean, it's publicly announced where an exam is coming up. You know, it's out there. A lot of the community groups look at that. I would say I'm trying to invite, you know, a deluge here, a deluge of criticism, but I guess our last exam, we had one person write in advance of the exam to offer comment or thoughts about what we should do, what we were doing, and I guess I'm always surprised by that. Observation.
So now I want my time back. I think and not to disagree, I think that there are some elements about the public role that maybe could be strengthened for sure. And in terms of the service test, since that's our subject, I don't see how, based on the information collected by the examiners and available to the public, you could really get a handle on how, whether you'd have any basis for complaint or for protest or for recommendation for changes. It's just too hard to get your hands on what the bank is doing. And it's completely impossible to assess what's happening in a single marketplace on the service side from what is collected in CRA. And to the extent that, you know, the way the HMDA data has been used to really engage the community in the dialogue with the financial institutions, I think something on the service side should be put in place before you decide that there's no community comment on that area. I just think it's difficult for the community to get engaged. And I might add, the quality of the product matters too. So we also need to not just recognize when a bank has branches in the right communities and is offering checking accounts. There's this anecdote that we hear a lot about the great CRA product that a bank has, but then that product never gets offered to anybody. So that's something you'd need to examine further. And then the other side, of course, are the products which might drain resources from the communities that are being offered as well that would feed into that. Thank you.
Let me jump in here and move to our second round of questions if I can. You actually, in response to a number of questions by Vice Chairman Grunberg, you answered a number of follow-up questions that I have. So what I'd like to do is to, perhaps at least for purposes of my question, change the focus a little bit, which is to the current definition of community development, which includes activities that promote development by financing businesses and farms that meet the Small Business Administration size standards for, quote, small entities or entities that have gross annual revenues of $1 million or less. Should size limitations and dollar limitations be raised for activities that promote economic development in rural areas? And I'd like to hear from all of you, and whoever's next up can start. probably you, Mr. Griffin.
Great. The one topic I don't have much of a thought on.
That's fine. That's fine.
I'll pass on that one.
I'll pass, too.
Okay. Okay. Mr. Stegman.
I don't have anything to add to that.
Okay. All right. Ms. Radcliffe.
So specifically your question is about whether the size and dollar limitations on small business lending in rural markets should be raised.
Correct. That's, to provide additional assistance to if it's appropriate to rural areas.
I can't think of any reason not to support that. But
okay.
I'll have to study it some more.
All right, let me go to my next question, which is, as we, the regulators, evaluate how institutions provide retail access to banking services, should negative consideration be given to high-cost products, such as accounts with very high overdraft fees? And again, not to let you off with a yes or no, if so, how would that be measured, and how should it be incorporated into the rating?
I think Melissa starts.
You're next.
I think you're going to hear some of this a little later in some of the other panels.
Exactly.
We are not making that recommendation. I fully understand where that recommendation is coming from, but our response is that we have a new cop in town called the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and that entity is going to be charged with policing the marketplace. And let's give that entity the authority to identify bad products and figure out what to do with them. Also, that the CRA is designed in order to increase access to good products. So let's really use that and leverage it to get good products out there in the marketplace.
Although I would also suggest, if I could, that for institutions of $10 billion or less, the regulators will have primary supervisory authority, examination, et cetera, will more likely than not be those providing exam ratings. And so I don't want to dismiss the question by
point.
Saying, let's wait for the next cop.
Completely fair point, but I think that those products that are considered high risk or predatory for consumers are likely to be quite clearly identified through this new Protection Bureau. Mm-hmm. And so this goes back to my recommendation that there is good coordination between the CRA regulators and the Consumer Protection Bureau when there are those circumstances where the authority isn't
right.
Explicit.
Which I'm comfortable there will be lots of coordination going forward. So, Ms. Boulder.
My answer is yes. I do think that offering negative products is such an amorphous term, so acknowledging that should be considered, in particular if those are the products that the institution is putting forward to serve the low and moderate income community. There's always this argument that a product taken out of context was really meant for somebody else but used by a low income person or a first account person. That wasn't the right fit. So I don't want to get into an argument of whether this high-end product was really intended for somebody else and therefore they should have it on their books. But in the context of those products being offered to the market that we're talking about, it is problematic. And in creating the benchmarks, I have in my written statement, things to look for are things like affordability, community uptake, presence of hidden fees, and length of time open. And then also looking at flags, such as accounts being opened and closed quickly over a period of time, abnormal rates of defaults on small dollar loans, and consumer complaints as being important to consider. And I think that what that does for you is give you a sense of whether or not, again, these are the right products that respond to what it is the community actually needs.
Thank you.
I would not conflate high-cost products with abusive products and have never been one to argue that subprime was equivalent to predatory lending and so on. So I would really look to the features and the terms to make that decision, not purely high cost. But I also, and you'll get into this with the other panels, the idea of being able to really have these kinds of consumer kind of dangerous products outside of your assessment area, but not in your assessment area, I think is something that, and allowing banks to choose whether or not an affiliate should be part of their exam, all of those things have to be really, I think, changed as we go. And I do think in the community development, the kind of lending area, sustainability, sustainable mortgage products, sustainable homeownership, and those kinds of things really have to be given credit. In the service test, since you can't unbundle the 20% that's not the kind of branches, it's very hard to say how would you impose kind of negative credit in some cases. I would have to kind of think about that. But I would also point out what Michael said. There's not really great incentives anymore for an outstanding, and I really want to imbue the system with that kind of incentive, which I think is as important as anything before I start talking about negative credit on the financial services side.
Thank you. Another alternative that builds on some comments I think that were delivered at earlier hearings is the idea of maybe so classifying an account on the transaction account side maybe as a CRA, say, friendly type product. So to the extent that you, I know just to have a sort of an approach, propose an approach, is that you could maybe sort of grade the kinds of products that are offered and give more credit to the distribution of the products that are demonstrated to be good quality CRA-oriented type products. And so it doesn't necessarily mean punishing the bad products. Right. But then, you know, there is obviously certain behaviors and blatant, activities that ought to be always taken. It's just like on the mortgage side when you could bury in your affiliate some activity that ran afoul of fair lending laws and not count that in CRA. That sort of thing, obviously, we should address.
Agreed. Thank you.
I guess I would say certainly if somebody's engaged in a predatory activity, that should be addressed. But I think it's addressed under other laws, other examinations. You know, I think about certainly there's already that out there on fair lending. If someone's certainly trying to take advantage of a protected class, that failure of that test already impacts the CRA exam. So certainly I'm not going to sit here and advocate for sticks to beat me with. So,
thank you. Vice Chairman Grunberg. Vice Chairman Grunberg, are you still there?
Yes, I had the mute off. I wanted to come back to a point raised by Mr. Griffin in his testimony that in discussing the efforts of his institution to offer low-cost basic banking services, as well as the location of branches in low and moderate income communities, the goal was not simply to provide the services, such as check cashing, for example, but to develop a relationship with the bank for these customers. And I wanted to ask Mr. Griffin, one, did the activities of the bank, both the branch locations and the services, meet with some success? And then I'd like to ask the other panelists, in effect, should this be a goal of CRA beyond offering individual services, getting banks to offer particular services or products? Is there a value for low and moderate income people for developing a bank relationship? And should indeed this be recognized explicitly by CRA, which I think was one of the suggestions Mr. Griffin made as well. If we could start with Mr. Griffin and then perhaps get responses from the other panelists.
Sure. I would say yes, our products, our KeyBank Plus sort of approach has met with success. We certainly continue to expand it to other areas, so we continue to look at physically where we can expand it, but also the product offering we can expand. One thing that's become very clear to us is offering one product that people are currently utilizing, for example, check cashing, isn't going to keep them with you.
if you don't offer the similar products, you know, the associated products of bill pay, money orders, remittance products. I mean, really, if you want to capture that business, you've got to develop that full suite of products to keep them with you, because otherwise they have to go somewhere else to do those activities. So who's going to make two trips somewhere to do that? So certainly has met with success. And it's also met with success not just on the uptake on those products. You know, as we talk to our branches and evaluate what's going on for those branches that have the KeyBank Plus program, what we find is sometimes people will come in because they saw the check cashing. Again, that's what they were coming in for. They didn't think they could get a checking account or a savings account because they had issues with a checking account previously, may think they're still on check system, something like that. And sort of anecdotally, what we found is a lot of folks come in looking for the check cashing, but end up, because they realize they can open other accounts, handling those services, getting different products so they can handle their financial services differently.
And if I could just ask the other panelists to comment, should we be encouraged? Is part of the goal here with the services test to encourage banking relationships for people in low and moderate income communities?
I'll jump in on that. This is Janice. I think relationships do matter, and in my statement, I tried to really sort of hedge between the question, or not really pit them against each other in terms of branches versus technology. What we have found in focus groups with Latino consumers is that a good branch can make all the difference. It's where families go to find a bilingual agent. They can have somebody that's going to walk them through the details of their account or their first credit card, and that they really rely on that. One-on-one, high-touch service is still really important. And I do think that is an important goal. I just think I would only caveat by saying that it's not the only way that families will ever interface with the banking system. But certainly relationships are important, and I think there's high rewards for that in graduation, Mike, much as Mike was mentioning.
The argument originally was made that an investment in the unbanked by an institution would develop kind of a loyal kind of customer base, and over the long term, even if those initial products didn't show much return, over time they would migrate kind of upmarket into more profitable products. I haven't seen a whole lot of studies about that. I do think, obviously, a mainstream banking relationship is terribly important, but I would not really kind of look to kind of connect at the hip low-income communities with a particular financial institution when people shop all over the market for the best deal for themselves. So I always thought that the argument for banks was to invest in the customer development because it's really in your interest to do it. I always want to give the consumer, obviously, maximum market choice.
I just have a quick question. Mr. Stegman, in your testimony, I was reading the part about your idea about the Independent Institute for Financial Innovation, Research, and Evaluation, and there was the discussion about who should pay for that, and you mentioned what you call mega banks. And then you also talk about the 10 largest CRA-covered institutions in the country having $3.1 trillion in deposits and a combined market share of about 45%. What I was wondering is whether or not you were, or any of you were thinking about whether we have things pegged the right way in terms of how we've sort of separated institutions into different categories for purposes of evaluation. We've talked about smaller banks today and intermediate small banks and large banks, but you raised this issue about mega banks, and I wonder whether or not there's anything in there about, or any thoughts to whether or not there should be, and you talk about the duty of duty to lead concept in there as well. And I wondered whether or not we were, do we have things sort of pegged the right way, or should we be considering another strata of institution for purpose of developing a whole separate set of performance tests or evaluation criteria?
Well, I won't take any more time because I kind of proposed that, and I'd like to hear other panelists, but it strikes me between 1995, when we really made those last changes in terms of performance with all of the consolidation and the market consolidation, which has really, really ramped up in the last several years, and now we're at a point where we really do have another tier of institution. And the idea of just looking at services, investment, and lending as if these institutions shouldn't really have a kind of a mandate to really change some of the dynamics that we've been talking about, I think totally kind of misses the policy point. So I would obviously say, yes, we should be looking at that super tier.
I completely agree with that, and I think it might be worth, without having a very concrete proposal in mind, it still might be worth also looking at not just tiered tests, but a tiered incentive structure so that it really does encourage behavior dependent on what you're asking each kind of institution to do.
I really haven't thought about that, but certainly like the tiered incentives. Anything that talks about incentives, I'm up for it.
I agree with Janneke.
Thank you.
I would like to go back to the issue of the community development test. A couple of you have mentioned it in a few different ways, and I guess my question to all of you is, are you all in agreement or are all saying that there should be a separate community development test for every type of institution? I will start with that.
Yeah, I mean, I'll go ahead. I guess where I come to for a community development test and why it sort of strikes a chord with me is, again, I come from a background of working at Community Development Corps developing affordable housing. And I always look at the community development lending, which when people think about community development or CRA, I think that's what comes to mind for most people, the sort of construction loans for affordable housing, the new markets tax credit lending, you know, those types of things. And I think there's this belief that it gets the majority of the weight in the lending test. And when community development lending is really only additive to small business and mortgage, I think it gets overshadowed. And again, doesn't encourage some of the most important lending that goes on to redevelop communities. So I think about that, sort of pulling that out of the lending test, pulling those community development services out of the service test, to really highlight those and say, again, if you're doing these in a pretty spectacular way, you deserve an outstanding, you know, you deserve something for that. And so to highlight the importance of those things, I think that's why I sort of move towards a community development test overlaying the rest of it.
I think those are really good points that Mike is making. I think that, again, I'm saying this quite repeatedly, but I think it really does come back to where the institution is and where its focus is, and not necessarily all the institutions are thinking about or doing really explicit some of the investment types of activities under the community development test. So if it really is sort of fitting the plans of the business, of the bank and what they're doing, then that should be there, but I don't think it is necessarily in place for all of them.
So my understanding, and I don't necessarily feel that I'm the expert on this, but the way the tests work is the smaller you go in the categories, they sort of meld together, and that actually most banks don't have the three distinct tests. So when I say that I think that all banks should be
sort of graded on the criteria that we've mentioned here. We also point out that that is in the concept of, you know, these banks have more streamlined tests. It's just that even though they're streamlined, all of these same criteria are eligible to be evaluated. And so I don't necessarily argue that those tests should be split out for those smaller institutions, but that under the umbrella of things that they, for which they can be evaluated, we could do a better job of assigning benchmarks to that. And specifically on the community development test, what we argue for is something that would be akin to investments in CDFIs, but would be investments in other institutions that would encourage either the taking of deposits or issuing of starter credit or credit builder loans, and that would be, you could actually quantify that. And so I think that would probably be bigger institutions investing in smaller institutions, but could be peer-to-peer investment, again, as a way to meet the totality of needs within a market. That, I think, you can do within the way that the community development test is structured now. It's just that it's not, to the idea that people teach to the test, that's not graded right now, and it's not encouraged.
I have a follow-up. So you had mentioned this third-party investments, and then I think in your opening statement you had mentioned that that recipient of those investments should also be evaluated. Can you talk a little bit more about what that would look like?
Sure. The point was really that people shouldn't be allowed to make an investment that skirts the rules or spirit of CRA. And so the examples that I use are investments in community banks and credit unions to enable what they're already doing well. And so the idea is that a larger bank, and again, if we're assessing based on everywhere a bank is doing business, and maybe they primarily have an internet presence, let's say in a metro area, it might make more sense for them to put a deposit in a credit union that has expertise and further enable them to do their work, in which case the risk, because they have a choice then of where to put their investment, they need to put it in a place that's acting responsibly, and they need to gather information to make that case. And this goes to points that were made earlier, that they shouldn't be allowed to count activity or hide activity in an affiliate that's going to skirt the rules. So if you go this investment strategy and make a strategic decision that your institution's not going to offer, let's say, small dollar credit, but you're going to enable a great credit union who is doing this really well, you can't make an investment that's going to run afoul of fair lending laws or is somehow harming the community.
Okay.
All right.
Yes?
And with that, I'll bring our first panel to its conclusion. Thank you, Janice, Michael, Yannicka, Michael, and Melissa for your time and your insights. We'll take a 15-minute break, and I would strongly encourage all attendees to be back here at 11 o'clock. Thank you.